this time on your weekly Constitutional.
In a number of ways, America and its constitutional ideas have been at the foundation of an international conversation with other countries, especially after World War II, an era in which there was a vast expansion of constitutional liberal democracy in places around the globe. And I thought if time permitted today, we might talk a little bit about what's been happening in recent years in some of the countries in which democracy appears to have been planted, but now it's, there seems to be some rollback.
That was A.E. Dick Howard, the White Burkett Miller Professor of Law and Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and this week it's about constitutional migration.
Stay tuned for your weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights, produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law.
I recently had the honor of participating in a conference called Virginia in the Vanguard at Montpelier. It was all about Virginia's important role in establishing American constitutional democracy and how we might build upon that tradition in the future. One of the other participants was a man I've had on the show before and whom I've long admired. His name is A.E. Dick Howard. He's a professor at the University of Virginia and one of the foremost experts, not just on American constitutional law, but on constitutions all over the world, many of which he has helped draft. So, of course, I collared Dick and I said, would you please sit down with me in the studio after the conference is over? And being the Virginia gentleman that he is, he immediately agreed. And he suggested that we talk about something he calls constitutional migration.
Nice to be here. Thank you. I feel like I'm in good company.
You're very kind to say so. Longtime listeners will remember the extraordinary two-part episode on Magna Carta that you and I did. I had intended only one episode on it, but you and I were sitting in a studio, a radio studio in Charlottesville, and you had even warned me. You warned me you had some grading you had to do and you really needed to get out of there within the hour, and then you wouldn't stop talking, and I wouldn't stop listening because it was such a great story. And that was back, I think, in 2015, because that was the 800th anniversary that we were getting ready for.
Exactly. That was 800 years after King John and the barons met at Magna Carta. And if you want to spend the next hour talking about Magna Carta, we can do that. But I have a feeling that's not why we're here today.
What I will do is I will refer people to our podcast site. And we're also, of course, on iTunes and Spotify and everywhere else. Just Google your weekly Constitutional. And then when you get to the search bar, just put in Magna Carta and you will very quickly come up with both of those episodes. And they are wonderful. And I have been waiting 4 years to get you back in a studio with me. So what are we going to talk about today?
Well, you and I chatted before we sat down in the studio about taking a look at how American constitutional ideas have traveled from the American founding in this country to other places. That we obviously care about and talk about American history and what the framers did, what it means to our time, how constitutional ideas have evolved over the centuries. But I think it's a less known story, but very important, that as global constitutionalism has taken shape, the way in which American ideas were at the center of that conversation, how they've been borrowed and transferred and transmitted to other places in Europe and beyond, a voluntary exchange of ideas that they simply stood or fell on their own merits, sometimes not so voluntary by way of colonization, as in the Philippines, for example, or after war by way of military imposition, as in Japan in the time of MacArthur. Mm-hmm. But in a number of ways, America and its constitutional ideas have been at the foundation of an international conversation with other countries, especially after World War II, an era in which there was a vast expansion of constitutional liberal democracy in places around the globe. And I thought if time permitted today, we might talk a little bit about what's been happening in recent years in some of the countries in which democracy appears to have been planted, but now it's, there seems to be some rollback.
That is a fantastic idea. And you mentioned we discussed this previously. We're actually both at Montpelier for a wonderful event that has just concluded, and it's going to be the commemoration of 1619. And the commemoration of 1619, especially in Virginia, talks about several extremely important things that happened. Establishment of the first representative body in the country, the House of Burgesses, the importation of slaves for the first time. Beyond that, the first Thanksgiving, apparently, in the United States. And finally, last but not least, the encouragement of women to come to Virginia for the very first time, which it seems to me someone should have remembered that a bit earlier. But okay, all very important things. We just had a marvelous experience with JMU and with the other partners in Virginia who are doing this, and it was a wonderful time. And part of the wonderfulness of it was the fact that we get to have these side conversations. And so thank you very much for coming again. And your idea is fantastic. I think you also told me that you wanted to start not with our Constitution, but with our Declaration of Independence.
I think that's right. I mean, if you want a starting point for this international conversation, it would be the Declaration, because one recalls that when Jefferson and his colleagues agreed to that Declaration, part of the language, it really begins with the admonition that this is a declaration not simply for Americans, but for the world. That Americans, in stating their case for a break with Great Britain, the case for independence, they wanted to make their case to mankind generally, to the world, to say that we have a civilized mission. We think these are the rights that have been violated. These are the claims we make, which have brought us to an unfortunate break with the mother country. I think it was a conscious notion that the ideas that lay at the foundation of Americans' democracy, their incipient democracy, were ideas that were not uniquely the possession of the American people, but were the claim of mankind generally. Certainly that was Jefferson's idea. He thought that people around the world might actually follow the American model, that it might be inspirations for people with similar hopes in other places.
So this is from the very beginning. We thought, we're basically saying, hey, here are some really good ideas. Here's why we're doing this. And implicitly, maybe you should think about this too.
I think that's right. And there was correspondence, essays, messages that carried back and forth across the Atlantic, especially between France and America, because the so-called philosophes, the intellectuals in France during the latter part of the 18th century, these were children of the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment, after all, was something, was a period that affected both Europe and America. There were common ideology of language of ideas like liberty and equality and human dignity and human purpose. These were the rhetoric of liberty was common to both sides of the Atlantic. And as a result, when the American Revolution broke out, when the Declaration was agreed upon and the hope for independence was still just in its infancy, the French and other Europeans were fascinated by this because they could see the Americans actually putting into play things which had just simply been ideas up to that point, been sort of conversations and shared notions. But there had not been any practical accomplishment, because the French, after all, were still under the thumb of the Ancien Régime, the Louis, the Bourbon, monarchs, whereas the Americans now were about to create their own government based upon the consent of the governed. So this was a fascinating period. It's interesting that when the French Revolution broke out, 1789, July of 1789, one of the early steps they took was fashioning what came to be called the Declaration of Rights of Man and the Citizen, 1789. And if you lay that declaration side by side with the Virginia Declaration of Rights, 1776, you see the affinity. In fact, when Jefferson was our minister in Paris, he had conversations with Lafayette and some of the other French leaders. And so when the French drafted their declaration, they were strongly influenced by and drew ideas from the Virginia Declaration of Rights. So there was a close affinity there. Then as you move into the period of constitution making in France, when they began work on their first constitution in 1791, It's quite remarkable to read the debates in the National Assembly. There was a radical faction which cited by way of their model the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776 because it was among the first American state constitutions. It was the most radical.
It was the most democratic, wasn't it?
The most democratic. It had a unicameral legislature, annual elections, frequent turnover in office. In many ways, it was calculated to keep government in Pennsylvania close to the people, close to the population. Then in the National Assembly in France, there was a more moderate faction, which appealed to the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780 as their model. And that was a constitution largely drafted by John Adams. And unlike the Pennsylvania Constitution, the Massachusetts document was bicameral, had checks and balances, it had more power to the governor than Pennsylvania had, it had a stronger judiciary. It was the emerging American model, which finally, of course, became the model at Philadelphia in 1787. So here you had the French, the two factions debating what they ought to do by way of a French constitution, and the two sides were appealing respectively to two different American state constitutions. It's unimaginable today that a French debate would revolve around American models.
I know.
The French are very proud people, and they simply wouldn't do that. And yet back in the 1790s, that's exactly what they did.
Perhaps they consoled themselves with the idea that, okay, these Americans wrote this up, but these are all our ideas anyway.
They could talk about how those ideas were already circulating
right.
in France. Well, the choice the National Assembly finally made was a very important one because they chose the more radical path. They rejected bicameralism. They rejected separation of powers. They rejected checks and balances. Drawing upon the philosophy of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, they saw the National Assembly as embodying the will of the people, the popular will. So as time passed, the National Assembly became the embodiment of the general will of the French nation. And the result was to oppose the National Assembly was to oppose the French people, and that, of course, was treason. And the result finally was the Reign of Terror, the tumbrils, the guillotine, all that familiar history, that even though there was this common rhetoric on both sides of the Atlantic between the French and the Americans, the constitutional paths they chose were radically different. The Americans adopting French ideas, Montesquieu's ideas of the separation of powers, checks and balances and the like. The French adopting a more radical course, drawing in good part from Jean-Jacques Rousseau, putting the power of the French people into one body without checks and balances. And of course, history records the difference, how different American history and French history. I'm sure there were other factors. I'm not pretending that just the structure of government alone dictated the result. But in many ways, those competing constitutional choices reflected where the history of the two countries were going. And of course, America had its rough times after 1787, but there was no revolution, there were no summary executions and the like, the way you saw in France in the 1790s.
Let me pause there, Dick, because I was aware of the general chronology here and that things went pretty badly pretty quickly after the revolution. But you're saying that's specifically traceable, at least in part, to their decision to have a unicameral legislature that had wielded unchecked power. So they had disregarded Montesquieu's own separation of powers theory, and that was the result they got.
Exactly right. I would qualify that by saying I'm not suggesting cause and effect. I'm not saying because they chose a system without checks and balances, the result was the Reign of Terror. What I am suggesting is that choice reflected the path of French history at the time, that it was part of the calculus of focusing power in one place, an approach which Americans have rejected. We have adopted Montesquieu's idea that power should be dispersed. Now, I think in many ways the course of world history can be traced to those fundamental choices in France and America. You can trace the path from the French Revolution to the Russian Revolution in 1918, And on the American side, you can trace, I'd like to talk a little bit in this program about some of the examples of ways in which other countries have modeled themselves on the American experience. Mm-hmm. But those are the two fundamental choices. You can either have an authoritarian government with power focused, we know of many examples of that today, or you can have a system in which you have independent courts, you have checks on the executive, you have a sort of a Madisonian notion of competing factions and the like, which keep power from being focused in a single body.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. This week, my guest is A.E. Dick Howard of the University of Virginia. And in addition to his many other accomplishments, Dick has a melodious speaking voice. Don't you agree? Stick around. We'll talk to him some more. And now it's time to continue our discussion with A.E. Dick Howard of the University of Virginia. He's talking about something he calls constitutional migration, the migration of constitutional ideas all over the world. Sometimes things work out, as with James Madison. Sometimes, not so much. The French just traded one tyrant for a bunch of tyrants, and they had not developed, at least by that time, the concept of a loyal opposition. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but the British were already moving toward parliamentary supremacy, and arguably that they have the same thing. They've got, well, it is a bicameral body, but most of the power is in the House of Commons, and it's all concentrated there. It all emanates from London, and yet they don't act in an authoritarian fashion. They have parties, and the parties respect one another's minority rights.
It's interesting that among the nations of the world, virtually all of them have a written constitution, and that to become a nation in the world we live in is to imply that automatically you have to have a constitution to speak for that country. The exceptions are very few, and the most obvious exception is the United Kingdom, which has the famous unwritten constitution, and yet over the centuries it's evolved in a way. It goes back to Magna Carta, to the English Bill of Rights, to the so-called Glorious Revolution, to the Great Reform Act of 1832. There have been a number of landmarks along that process, but they've developed a system in which at least the tradition is some notions of constitutional restraint, some notions of kind of a middle way, even though there was not a written constitution to dictate the result. I have to say that the Brexit debate suggests that maybe the British Parliament's coming unglued at the moment. Mm. It's if Boris Johnson, for example, becomes Prime Minister, I think all bets are off. But the strains are evident. Nevertheless, at least in modern history, you could hold out the UK Parliament and the British system in general as being a model of the implied restraints on self-government.
Right, right. All right, so the mother country has gone its own path. We've gone our Madisonian path. The French have rejected our approach. And then you said, you even think that the Russian Revolution was inspired by us?
I think that not by us, by the French Revolution.
Okay.
I think the notion that the power which the Bolshevik Party took upon itself, you know, there was the first phases of the revolution, there was the Mensheviks, mm-hmm. were the sort of moderates who were in control. There was the embryo of a parliamentary democracy that might have evolved in Russia, but the Bolsheviks stamped out that effort early on and imposed the rule of a single party who spoke for the people. It was a popular, in quotation marks, a popular revolution, and in that sense echoed the French notion that it was the people's revolution reflected in their National Assembly. The idea of a people, a nation, in a corporate sense, obliterating the sort of autonomy of individuals is very much at the heart of the Russian Revolution of 1918, that the party represented the movement towards the classless society, Marx's perfection. This turned out not to be the case. I mean, it turned out that the party had to remain, the state did not wither away by any means after the Russian Revolution. But I think the competing train has been a fascinating one, starting with the American founding period. And then you watch, for example, in 19th century Europe, as liberalism begins to take shape, take the revolutions of 1848, for example, where revolutions broke out in all over Europe. 1848 is a major event in European history.
Can we pause there, Dick? Because I think 1848 is not particularly well known in this country.
Right.
Could you tell us a little bit about what happened generally in Europe in 1848?
Yeah, 1848 was a period where liberal ideas, and what I mean by liberalism is not the sort of popular connotation of the present political debate in America. I mean classic liberalism, the notion that you should have an educated population, that there should be free speech, free press, free exercise of religion, restraints on the state to allow individual liberty to flourish. That's classic liberalism. It's the liberalism of John Stuart Mill, for example, and others in the 19th century. That idea was really taking hold in the first half of the 19th century in Europe, despite the fact that the great powers were still ruled by rather tyrannical regimes, for example, the Austrian Empire, the Prussian Empire, the like. These states were very much in being and held power. There were popular movements, liberal movements, which, as I say, broke out in a number of major cities in Paris and Budapest and a number of other places almost simultaneously around the continent. And at first, it looked like they would really take hold. In Germany, for example, there was a convention in Frankfurt in the Paulskirche Church in which liberals, mostly lawyers and professors and civil servants and the like, convened to write a constitution which they hoped would become a German constitution. And if you read those debates of 1848, it is fascinating to see the German intellectuals, the reformers, citing the American experience. There was a professor, for example, from Heidelberg who said the American constitution is the one we ought to study. Their Supreme Court is a model. We should have judicial review in this country. So they wrote a constitution which incorporated federalism, very much an American idea, judicial review, also an American idea based on John Marshall's Marbury versus Madison. So it had sort of American handprints all over it, even though it was a German constitution. It never actually took effect because the conservative powers in Prussia and Austria moved to sort of stamp it out. So the 1848 revolutions in Europe were largely failures in the immediate political sense, but they had long-lasting effect. Again, Germany comes to mind if you look at today's basic law of Germany, which is their constitution, written in 1949. You find that they have a constitutional court with judicial review powers. They have a federal system where the respective German states are very important parts of the federal model. And you read that and you see how the 1848 ideas survived as part of German constitutional culture to surface in 1949, a century later. And that is a way of showing the ultimate influence of American ideas by way of 1848 reappearing in 1949. There's so many interesting stories like that that you can follow of places that clearly were writing their own constitutions, reflecting their own traditions, their own history, their own culture, and yet they looked at the American model as being a practicing experiment in self-government.
Well, we like to say on this show, in fact, our tagline is, you are a part of the American experiment. And when I first started saying that, I thought to myself, that sounds a little chauvinistic. I mean, I hope that there are people in other parts of the world, other nationalities who are listening, and I didn't mean to suggest any sort of arrogance. But then I realized, no, that what you're saying is true, that these are perhaps to some extent American ideas or French ideas or British ideas, but the reason people are pursuing them is because they are universal. People given a choice want liberty. People given a choice want equality. I hope so. They certainly want their own liberties and their own freedoms, and they will choose those things if they're given the chance.
That's exactly right. Now, there are instances when American ideas have simply been imposed on other people. Mm-hmm. Their choice hasn't always been voluntary. After the Spanish-American War, for example, in 1898, we acquired the Philippines. And we acquired Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico, of course, remains a commonwealth within the American system. But in the Philippines, there was an American imperialist sort of sentiment at the time that we didn't have empires like the French and the Germans and the British. But here we had this, we had acquired this foreign country, which had been Spanish for 300 years. And the leaders in America at the time, from the president down, set out to, in effect, Americanize the Philippines, to introduce self-government, courts like the American courts, an education system like American education. And they tried to plant these ideas with only partial success. The Philippines became independent in 1946, right after World War II. And I'd have to say, if you look at the Philippines today, it's not a model of self-government. It really is a fairly chaotic place. It's a reminder that as universal as American ideas are, as universal as hopes for democracy and liberalism and freedom might be, that a government has to be shaped to reflect the culture, the history, the traditions of a particular people. It has to be planted. One of my friends in the Philippines, I was actually there at the time of the People's Power Revolution that ousted Marcos brought.
You were in the middle of that.
I was in the middle of that.
Oh,
I was
my.
There at the time. And I asked one of my Filipino friends to explain to me Philippines history. And he said, well, Professor, you have to imagine living 300 years in a convent and 50 years in Hollywood. And then you see the dissonance of the Philippine experience.
Right.
So the Philippines story is a reminder that some American ideas, they have a constitution that looks rather like ours. The University of the Philippines, at which I gave lectures, reminds you of a land-grant college. You think you might be at Kansas State or someplace
right.
like that. They have Rotary Clubs. I spoke to the Rotary Club, to the Bar Association. I mean, so many of these things are so American, and yet the underlying culture can only be explained by looking back to Iberian history of the 17th century. Those ideas are part of Filipino culture, and therefore you can't pretend to simply take an American idea and transplant it. You know, the Japanese story is a fascinating one, which actually suggests the ambiguity of constitutional transplantations, and that is, after World War II, the Americans were victorious both in Europe and in Asia. And MacArthur was in charge of things, the military government in Tokyo. He was the shogun of Japan, in effect. And the Japanese government remained in existence, unlike Germany, where it had collapsed completely. But the emperor was still in place, the government was still in place, and the Japanese were expected to write a constitution. But they were dragging their feet. It looked like they were just going to tinker a bit with the old 1885 constitution, which had been the pre-war constitution. And MacArthur got worried that the Russians might come in and get a slice of the action the way they had done in Berlin. And so he told his military, his civil government team, to write him a constitution. And I guess if you worked for MacArthur, you just saluted and said, yes, sir, when would you like to have it on your desk?
I think you did.
And 7 days later, they had a draft. It took them 1 week to write a constitution. And so...
And let me, if I may interject there, there's a really wonderful story that's often overlooked, and that has to do with the provision on women's rights in that
yes.
constitution. Could you share that?
Well, it's interesting that one of the members of this small team was a woman. The team was very young. They were people in their 20s and 30s mostly, and they were New Dealers for the most part. Mm-hmm. They'd had experience in Washington. And the woman in question got women's rights provisions into the draft, but most of them got taken out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, some of them got in.
It got watered down so that, yes, there was a remnant left, but by Japanese standards, it was still pretty remarkable. Well, this draft leaked out as somebody got it out to the press. And when it leaked, the Japanese were appalled because they thought they were going to get to write the Constitution, and here was this American draft. They didn't have a lot of choice in the matter. Mm-hmm. So it was presented to the Japanese Diet, their parliament. Mm-hmm. It was approved. And the Japanese people, I think it's fair to say at that time, didn't realize the extent to which it was really an American product. So it became, it was adopted as the Constitution of Japan. Now, you would assume, as time passed and the American military left and the Japanese were left in control of their own affairs, you would suppose that the Japanese would have said, right, the Americans are out of here, let's scrap this American Constitution and write our own Constitution. Well, it's interesting, all these years later, that original Constitution is still in force without any amendments whatever. It's never been amended. Now, there's debate over whether the so-called Article 9, the peace amendment, should be taken out or left
in.
That's
the one that limited their military to purely self-defense?
Renounced war and renounced the use of a military force. It's still in place. And I think what you have to conclude is the Japanese have taken that Constitution and domesticated it. So if you look at the actual practice under that Constitution, it's really Japanese, even though the document itself is American. So it's one of those examples of where superficially something looks American, but once you understand the local culture, then you know what the actual practice is. Now, I think perhaps the most contemporary story you and I might talk about is what happened in Central and Eastern Europe after the collapse of communism.
Mm-hmm.
After the Berlin Wall came down in 1989.
Those were heady days.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, let me ask you this. Did you ever think in your life that you would see popular uprisings which undermined and ultimately destroyed what we used to call the Eastern Bloc or the Soviet Bloc? And even the Soviet Union itself would dissolve?
I couldn't have imagined that. I mean, I came of age during the Cold War. I grew up with the Cold War. And so my worldview is essentially framed by the notion of two superpowers, each with its sphere of influence. And what had happened, I think that maybe the critical moment was the so-called Helsinki Agreement. This was in the 1980s. Poland had already seen martial law imposed after the rise of the Solidarity,
right.
trade union movement. So the fissures, the cracks were beginning to appear. But the Helsinki Agreement did two things. One, it ratified the existing boundaries of the European countries. So in that sense, it was a capitulation to the Soviet point of view, which is to say, here's what happened in 1945 and it won't change. But the other half of the Helsinki Agreement, the Soviets and the West signed off on a recognition of human rights. And the Soviets and a lot of people in the West thought that was just a bunch of talk, that was an empty, that we had given away a lot and gotten basically nothing in return. I think the fact is that the declaration of the Soviets agreeing to this set of human rights actually began to seep down to dissidents and dissenters in the Soviet bloc. And so you had movements like Vaclav Havel in Prague, Solidarity in Poland, and so forth, that dissenters were insisting that they wanted those human rights.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. This week, my guest is A.E. Dick Howard of the University of Virginia, who's telling us all about something he calls constitutional migration, the transfer of constitutional ideas all over the world. And it turns out quite a bit of that happened in Eastern Europe after the fall of the Soviet Union. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Dick Howard of the University of Virginia. He's been telling us most recently about the development of constitutionalism in Eastern Europe after the fall of the Berlin Wall. He knows all about it because it turns out he was there. I'll pick up on that. I remember this was the era of Solzhenitsyn, of Sakharov, of Soviet dissidents who often were in prison but would somehow get out their stories. I mean, they were writers. They wrote. I believe it was called Samizdat.
Yes,
Yeah, it was just individual pages that were written out by hand and then mimeographed. You know, somebody would type them up and mimeograph them and then pass from hand to hand and eventually would make their way out of the Soviet Union.
That's exactly right. I studied at Oxford for 2 years and I spent one of my summers in the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. That was 1960.
Okay.
It was actually the year that the U2 crash, Francis Gary Powers.
You were there
and all.
When Francis Gary. Good grief! You're like Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump. It's history. I was actually in Moscow. I saw the U2. The Soviets put the U-2 on display in Gorky Park in Moscow, and I went through the exhibit where they had all the propaganda about American spies and all the rest. And of course, to be in the Soviet bloc in 1960 was to be there when the relations between America and Russia were at their absolute nadir. Mm-hmm. Very few people traveled there. I was one of a handful. I had a classmate at Oxford who was a brilliant linguist and spoke fluent Russian.
Oh, that was nice.
And so as we traveled, we actually drove overland from Brest-Litovsk through what is today Belarus and Ukraine to Moscow, about 1,000 kilometers. And having a Russian linguist in the car, we could stop and talk to people and just get the sense of what ordinary folks were thinking. Totally a closed society. They had no way of getting genuine access to what was happening in the West. So my impressions of the Soviet Union were very much formed by having been there during the height of the Cold War. So as time passed in the 1980s, in the Helsinki period, frankly, I was among those surprised when things began to break apart as quickly as they did. I had a request from the State Department in 1988 to meet with a delegation of Hungarian drafters. They'd come to this country to talk about writing a new Constitution for Hungary.
What year was that?
This is 1988.
They're kind of looking forward. They're pretty optimistic, even before the Berlin Wall falls.
This is the year before the Berlin Wall came down. And so they came to Charlottesville. I spent 2 days with them. We talked about what do you do when you write a constitution. And I was dubious about the whole enterprise. I said, these people can't be real. These are communists. You know, they're a single-party government. They don't want checks and balances and all that sort of thing. Well, then they invited me to Budapest, and I went, still 1988. And as I spent some time in the city, I saw students setting up stands in the subway system, handing out leaflets and the like. And you could see that something was in the air. What I sensed was that the communist government kind of saw what was coming. They knew their system wasn't going to last forever. They thought if they wrote a constitution, they would get ahead of the curve and sort of ride it out and maybe get credit for it, which, as it turned out, they didn't. But things moved very quickly. 1989, the Berlin Wall came down. Of course, that was the critical moment, the opening up of the frontier. And it was a matter of weeks in places like Prague before the communist government had dissolved. Havel was the first post-communist president by the end of 1989. And because the satellite leaders realized, and the people realized, that the Russians were not going to send in tanks. Unlike 1956 in Budapest, unlike 1968 in Prague, that this time was going to be different. And sure enough, it was. And in a matter of months, it was transformed. And so this is a moment when Western people, myself included, were invited to come and consult on constitution making post-communist style. It was a time of openness, of exploration, almost a euphoric time. And you may remember that in 1992, Francis Fukuyama wrote this famous book about the end of history. And he predicted that constitutional liberal democracy was the wave of the future.
And I'll interject here that as happy as I was with these developments, I thought that was a really dumb idea. I don't think there's ever an end to history. And as much as I hoped that Fukuyama was right, I don't know. And all these people gloating about winning the Cold War, I thought that was entirely counterproductive. In fact, I understand that George H.W. Bush put out an order, we're not going to gloat about this. He was a good diplomat. He was a good man in many respects. As long as you've got an adversary, and Russia still existed, that has thousands of thermonuclear weapons, the conflict isn't over. And so, yes, euphoria typically dissipates, doesn't it?
Well, it was fascinating how, because the change had come about so quickly and so abruptly, Fukuyama and people like that were saying, well, it's going to take some time. I mean, Russia, China, that sort of thing, it's not going to happen tomorrow. But the tide is in the favor of liberal democracy. That's where the future really lies. And there was fair evidence of that. I used to hold out Hungary as being a success story,
right.
Poland as well, that they had, for example, in Budapest, they set up a very strong constitutional court modeled on the German constitutional court, and that Hungarian court was very strong in overturning laws that were impinging on individual rights. They actually enforced constitutional principles. Same thing with the Constitutional Tribunal in Warsaw and so forth. And so I may not have been euphoric, but I was essentially upbeat about the prospect.
Oh, yeah, that was a hopeful time.
Well, and American ideas were, by that point, part of the mix. I mean, they were not, I mean, I didn't go to those places saying, look, here's, I've got this Constitution in my pocket. Here it is, we the people of, and you just fill in the blanks and you can follow it.
Especially that fugitive slave clause thing. It's very important, yeah.
But some of my American colleagues seem to think that if they just brought that American Constitution with them, that's all they needed. Were they wrong about that? And what I did with each, I worked with several countries in the region, Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Romania, even Albania. And what I did was ask a lot of questions.
You say even Albania, which was notoriously the most repressive country, almost in the world perhaps, but certainly in Eastern Europe.
And it was the most isolated. They had no relations with any of the other communist countries, especially Yugoslavia, but not even with Russia. They had relations with China because China was so far away, it was not thought to be a problem. But Hoxha, the dictator in Albania, had tight-fisted control over the country. But even their ideas seeped through because they could turn on their television sets and listen to Italian television, which was just across the Adriatic. So when I was in Albania, I mean, I knew nothing about Albanian history. I was a history major in college, but my history ended at Vienna. You know, it was all Western European history.
Right.
It didn't talk about places like Albania. All I knew about Albania was that in Mozart's opera, Così fan tutti, the two lovers go off and to play a trick on their sweethearts. They come back dressed up as Albanians on the theory that nobody would really know what Albanian looked like. But so in Albania, I discovered a people who were at the same time xenophobic because of their history, but incredibly hospitable. Sort of the way mountain people often mm-hmm. are. So throughout the region, there was this notion, yes, we're going to see constitutional change. It turns out, if you look at developments today, that some of the bloom is off that particular rose, that trends have set in, I think in particular of Poland and Hungary, as places in which the tide is not in the direction of liberal democracy, but there seems to be a reverse tide.
Is what we commonly call populism here? Is that what we're talking about?
Absolutely.
Going all the way back to the French Revolution.
It's interesting. The French Revolution played on the fears, understandable fears of the French people that the other countries in Europe were going to defeat the French Revolution, that mm-hmm. they would come in and restore the Ancien Régime. And indeed, that's pretty much what happened after 1815. There was a restoration. And in Eastern Europe, the modern rulers, they're democratically elected. I mean, they're not undemocratic. These mm-hmm. are people who have had, they have elections. They are free elections. They're not fair elections. I mean, there are ways in which they fiddle with the electoral process, something we do in this country, unfortunately.
I'm sorry to say.
But these leaders, I'm thinking of Viktor Orban, for mm-hmm. example, in Hungary, democratically elected, but they then, in making policy, they began to undermine judicial independence, the free press, the independent bar, the private economy, on and on. They've, in combination of ways, they've really changed the contours of public life in those countries. And the forces at play are authoritarianism, populism, xenophobia, a general distrust of foreigners and the like. And I think most of those countries have a history which allows the rulers to play the victim card. The notion that these countries have been victimized. There's always somebody, some force. And in Eastern Europe, it's Brussels. It's right. The European Union. It's George Soros, which is...
yeah.
Sort of an anti-Semitic kind of strain in their politics.
Okay, Dick, you're scaring me because everything you've just said describes Weimar Germany. I mean, this looks to many people, I'm not the first to make this observation, like Germany in the 1930s, and we know how that story ended.
That's exactly right, because the Allies after World War I imposed such heavy reparations on Germany as to saddle the economy. The result was hyperinflation, the destruction of private fortunes and the like, and the military felt like they had been betrayed, and Hitler in his rise, I mean, it was a minority party at first. It was not a majority party by any means, but they succeeded in co-opting the industrial leaders, the others, who said Germany has been the victim of the French, the Americans, and the British. And so it helped fuel in the Weimar Republic the rise of the Nazi regime. So by the 1930s, having followed the facade of the rule of law, they managed to co-opt it and destroy it.
But we have to acknowledge they actually did have elections, and the elections, as you just described, were free elections for the most part, with lots and lots of intimidation by both the communists and the Nazis.
That's right.
Hitler did get a lot of votes. Hitler, I don't think, ever got an absolute majority of the votes, but he was powerful enough that Hindenburg decided, okay, I'm going to give him a chance to be prime minister. There'd been a rotating cast of characters before that. So Hitler comes in, and what does he promise? He's going to restore Germany's greatness. He's going to take care of all those Jews and all those foreigners that we don't like. He's going to be strong. He's going to make decisions, and he's going to talk like the people talk, and they're going to respect him for that. What does that sound like? I mean, it sounds like pretty much what you've been describing.
Well, I wouldn't want to overplay the comparisons. I think one should be worried about the trends in places like Eastern Europe. I think at this point I'm prepared to say that even though the sort of revisionist forces that seem to be at play, I don't predict the destruction of liberal democracy in those countries. I think it's being eroded in important ways, because in Poland, for example, they can point to how they've been trampled over the centuries by the empires. They were divided up in the 18th century by Russia, Austria, and by Prussia, Russia, and Austria. And Poland disappeared from the map of Europe between 1795 and 1918. And then, of course, came World War II with first the Nazis and the Soviets. So there's some real history there that gives them pause about trusting other peoples. Even so, I'm not going to predict at this point, at least, that these right-wing governments will finally become outright dictatorships, one-party systems, and the like. However, when you look at the contours of public life, at least in Hungary and Poland, you see that the checks that we in this country assume are important parts of a healthy and vibrant democracy, things like independent courts, free press, those forces, they clearly have been undermined and eroded in Poland and Hungary. It's cause for concern, and it's, I think, troubling that you see a reflection of that in so many parts of the world. Erdogan's Turkey.
Yes, but isn't it a little bit hopeful there? Now I'll be the Pollyanna guy. Didn't just recently they reverse the results of, well, actually they confirmed the results of the election for mayor in
Istanbul.
Istanbul. I always think Constantinople. I still mix that up. Byzantium. At any rate, the most populous city, the most powerful city there.
That's right.
And the more liberal forces took it away from this would-be dictator, Erdogan.
Exactly. You hope that that might at least give pause to Erdogan's. But the sad thing about Erdogan and Turkey is that 10 or 15 years ago, Turkey was being held out as the model of a democratic government which might spread throughout the Middle East.
Right.
Well, it turns out that Erdogan does want to be a model for the Middle East, but he wants it to be the renaissance of the Ottoman Empire.
Yes, yes, he does.
Which is sad. So as you go around the globe, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, you look, of course, at Russia. Putin's Russia is a resurrection of, in some ways, the czarist regime.
Yeah, he's allying himself with the Russian Orthodox Church. I mean, he wants to be czar.
Exactly. He wants czarist powers. And, of course, China's the ultimate case. We remember the time when people were saying, well, if China would adopt some kind of capitalism, if they would be brought into the modern economic sphere, become members of the World Trade Organization, become part of the international system, then democracy would follow. Well, that prediction turned out to be totally false. China has seen an incredible economic rise. They've taken advantage of the capitalist trading world. And yet, as we know, the party becomes more and more totalitarian all the time,
yes,
as people in Hong Kong will tell you.
Indeed. Well, okay, you've thoroughly depressed me now, Dick, but I will point out that there's at least one way in which this is not the 1930s all over again. In the 1930s, we had Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Oh, we don't have him now, do we?
We don't have Franklin Delano Roosevelt now, but, you know, I must say, I would not want to end this conversation on a downbeat or pessimistic note. I think if you look at the vicissitudes of American history, the times, the ratification debates, the debates over slavery in the 1840s and 50s, the Civil War and Reconstruction, the two world wars, the civil rights movement, the turmoil of the 1960s, and there were so many rough patches in that road, and yet I think the resilience of American democracy has been sustained. I have ultimate faith in the constitutional system that we have, that it will survive whichever party is in power, whoever holds the White House, whoever's has any of the engines of power. I think there's a core of constitutional system which will endure. I hope that's going to be true around the world. I think it's certainly true in this country.
Well, Dick, I hope that you're right. Otherwise, we'll have to clone Winston Churchill's DNA. Maybe he'll come back and save us all.
And if we're wrong, you know, they'll close down this program, won't they? And you won't be on
the
air.
I'll be the first one they shut down.
An often overlooked function of the United States Constitution is that it not only established a new system of government, but it also codified and sanctioned slavery as an economic system. Article 4, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution stated the following, quote, "No person held to service or labor in one state under the laws thereof, escaping into another, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim of the property to whom such labor or service may be due." End quote. This was known as the Fugitive Slave Clause. In 1850, Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Act, which gave more teeth to this clause of the Constitution. The law itself may have eased the problem in bordering slave states, but it exacerbated nationwide tensions over the so-called peculiar institution. This is Tyler Stanley with your Madison Minute.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to our guest, A.E. Dick Howard, the White Burkett Miller Professor of Law and Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. I'm Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment, no matter where you live.